clarity is the most important part of conversion, because it's all about immediacy and clarity, just being able to communicate your value prop clearly. And your value prop is typically communicated by your headline, your subhead, and the main hero image, the main media component, the picture.
Right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Hashtag Startup Basics series in the Insights Alley podcast, where startup founders and teams can learn from proven founders and experts about product, growth, sales, strategy, and everything in between to make their own startup successful. I'm your host, Arun Verma, and let's get started. In today's episode, we will talk to Ollie Gardner, who is a co-founder of Unbounce, which is a landing page building tool. Ollie is also a keynote speaker and one of the best experts on landing pages. And we would discuss with him everything that you need to know about landing pages, when, how, and why to build them and use them, and the key components and how to optimize them, etc. So here is the episode. Hello, Ollie. Welcome to Insights Alley. And thanks a lot for taking out some time for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
So, Ollie, would you like to start with telling us your story in brief, from your early career to co-founding Unbounce, and what are you up to these days?
Sure. Well, I'll kind of start at the beginning of Unbounce, then rewind a little bit. So we began almost 10 years ago, August 2009, which is the day I became a marketer. But going all the way back, the start of my career, I was actually a software developer, okay, which I kind of stumbled in by accident. Okay. So kind of hardcore, like financial stuff in London and UK. And then I gradually kind of moved that into the web back end, then front end web. Then I got into usability and interaction design. Then I was a creative director. And then, yeah, along the way, well, I moved to Canada, to Vancouver, and I met the co-founders in different startups around like 2000, and then some other some different companies. And then I guess we'd felt the pain of marketing teams in the different companies we worked at, where they were trying to get landing pages built, but there was always this kind of fight between marketing and engineering or the IT team, where we'd say, hey, we need this page built. And they'd respond with, well, we're building product. We don't really care about marketing. We don't want to spend our time building these pages. I mean, they would, but it would be big delays. And if you get something wrong, a big delay in getting it changed. So we did a little bit of validation, some Facebook ads, and interviewed a lot of marketers to see if it was a common pain. And everybody universally said, yes, we need a solution for this, a self-serve solution. So half of us quit our jobs, half of us weren't working for other, we're in between. And yeah, with the six of us, and we just decided, yeah, let's start a company. I mean, we'd all been entrepreneurial, done many things, but we'd never started a company before. So it was pretty exciting, you know, and a little scary. We didn't have any money. So it was, you know, I think a lot of founders go through that part of it.
Right. So let's start with the basics. Just a quick question. What is meant by a landing page, according to you?
Yeah, I think the first thing that's important to think about is the difference between different types of marketing traffic. Right. So you have marketing campaigns and you have organic search. Your website is something that you optimize over time for people to find you for the terms you want to rank for. Right. It's for building domain authority on Google, Bing, you know, on search. That's what your website is for. But landing pages are for individual campaigns. If you're running a marketing campaign, you're running ads, emails, whatever it is, you need somewhere to send that traffic that's very tightly tied message-wise, design-wise, to the purpose of that ad. Because usually ads are very specific. I mean, you'll do branded advertising, which is just about your main value prop, but a lot of it will be a lot more targeted. And if you send that traffic to your website, which is designed to be a bit more generic, then you're doing it wrong, and you will see lower performance for many reasons. Because, I mean, one of the fundamental reasons is that strong match between the ad and the landing page. So you're making a promise in your ad, Right. You're saying, I have this thing you searched for. And then if you don't deliver that immediately on your landing page, A, it's a bad experience, but B, Google will penalize you for that because if the bounce rate's higher, things like that, if they see it not succeeding, then they're going to raise your cost per click. Your quality score will go down.
Right.
First of all, your quality score will go down because they'll see that this is not designed for that ad. And it just has a knock-on effect, which costs you more money, lower performance. Your ads might not even show up. So it's really critical. If you want to get high quality scores, landing pages are kind of one of the key components of that.
Makes sense. So can you tell us more about like what different types of landing pages are there? So like it could be a lead generation landing page or a click-through landing page. So first of all, what do we mean by both of these and what other types could be there?
Yeah, those are the main categories functionally. You know, lead gen is obviously, as it sounds, it has a form on the page and it's designed to gather some kind of user data. So that's what a lead gen is all about. And a click-through really is like, it's an interstitial page. What that means is it's a step along a pathway. So you're using it to confirm what you're talking about in your advertising. Yeah, we have this thing, get them to read a bit more about it before you push them further down the funnel. So you're kind of warming them up a little bit. So they're the structurally the two main things, but then there are many use cases for each one. You know, click-through is very common for e-commerce,
right?
For example, where you'll maybe you're doing Instagram ads, Facebook ads for a product, you'll send them through to a, you know, for e-commerce things, it's so common now. There's so many products coming out through Kickstarter and all that kind of thing. And they, you know, when you click on that kind of ad, you want to come to a landing page which very closely mirrors the design aesthetic of your ad, the video, and the message. And then, you know, you'll either just have a longer kind of single page where you'll get them to buy, then the click through then is actually just to stick them into the purchase funnel, or it'll then take you to a deeper place on the website or something like that. But so that's functional, but there are many use cases that are, you know, like an early stage startup, there's so many ways that you can use a landing page that will just speed up everything you do. Right. It's not all about marketing kind of things. Lots of,
let's assume a scenario. So let's say a founder is on the day one of his or her startup journey. Okay, so in those days, the founders are thinking about just two things. One would be the validation of the hypothesis on their product, and of course, trying to acquire more and more users for their product. So could you tell us, shed some light with your own previous experience, why and how could founders use landing pages in doing exactly these two things?
Yes, mainly for speed. Because when you're starting out, you know, you need a website, but if you spend all of your time building that, writing your value proposition, designing it all around what you think is the true value of the product before you validate it, you know, you could be wasting a lot of time. So really, it's just about velocity. You can get a single page up really quick that talks about your value prop and gauges interest. You don't necessarily even have to have launched. So, you know, you can run ads or social, whatever it is, bring people in there. And then if they are interested, you get them on an email list, or you just basically come clean and say, hey, thanks for your interest. I'm validating this idea. Thanks to people like you clicking through and being interested. That's going to speed up our path to actually launching. Or it's just a great way of testing the different types of communication that you have, so that when you do build your website, you're doing it correctly. Because one of the common problems that happens when you're early stage, because you're busy and maybe you don't have a full set of tech talent, let's say, you know, maybe you're a non-technical founder. You still need a website. So the first thing you'll do probably is get a WordPress theme, just so you can get a website up and running quickly. But then the problem with that is, it's a templated system, right? It's got this design pre-built. You're like, oh, this is awesome. This is, you know, but then one of the first things you should do is cull it. You should go through and delete sections, because otherwise you're going to spend your time trying to fill in, make up content to fill in these areas on this your homepage and this website, when that doesn't necessarily mean it's the right thing to do. So it's really important if you go down that path to just start taking out a lot of things. Don't create content for the sake of it. I'm working on a little project right now, and I've gone through that exact process. Mm-hmm. And I saw myself doing it. I'm like, oh, this is a cool section. I'll start writing content for that. I'm like, no, don't do that. Just delete it. I don't need it. right? You just need the kind of main value prop kind of thing. And then we can talk about, you know, the anatomy of a landing page, the different things that go onto it. But really, it's about velocity and being able to get ideas out there quickly and share them with, you know, your colleagues, your network, your friends, your family, whatever, to see if they can understand what you're doing. Do some of that initial qualification that you're being clear in your communication.
Yeah, apart from communication also, like I can recall one example when I was working on a small idea and I just wanted to test, okay, if this is something that is actually useful to these people, not just the messaging, but the actual thing that, so I'll just wrote down the benefits and just tried to give anyone who could be the potential user. And if they are like going through, clicking through and giving us the email, then okay, then I'll reach out to them and try to do a customer development interview and just started the whole product building process from this landing page and not even writing a single line of code.
Yeah, and that's another great thing. Because maybe you aren't technical. And also you can do things like use a Typeform survey. Like they're really great and there are simple ways of putting out, like if you've got a social account or anything, putting out surveys to learn about your potential customer, because that's going to inform what you do on your landing page. And it's really easy to quickly get some feedback. And you also, if you're e-commerce or whatever it is, SaaS. If you're in SaaS, you're going to be thinking about pricing at some point. So you can start early on slapping a price on this thing and seeing what people think about that. Use an exit pop-up and ask people, like if they're leaving, hey, why are you leaving? Or why did you not interact or continue the purchase process here? You'll probably get some insights about pricing that way, but it's always a fear when you start that you're going to position yourself as too expensive. We're all afraid of asking for money, but you shouldn't be, because what you'll find in your journey as your product matures or as you learn more about your market, you'll start putting your prices up to push out people who aren't your ideal customer. So your prices will go up naturally, as it just always happens in SaaS. So don't be afraid of having a good, you know, asking for what you're actually worth. Now, obviously, you can't charge as much when you have a very thin product. And don't do price testing. That's illegal in a lot of countries, where you do an A/B test and there's a different price on each page. If it's functional, if you can actually pay for it, that's not a good thing. But you can just throw out one price and just kind of test the waters. And you can do that multiple times and see if there's different levels of impact or interest based on prices.
Right. So, Oli, let's talk about the components of a landing page, right? So I could think of, like, number one, let's say headline, copy, and the structure of the information on the landing page. Mm-hmm. Number two, let's say page navigation and folds. So top fold and the subsequent folds. Number three, let's say media components. So like pictures, graphics, videos. And finally, number four, forms with fields and CT, call to action buttons, right? So could you like guide us on these components one by one? I mean, what do we mean exactly by these components? And why are they important and like how to use them best? So let's start with the first component, headlines, copy, and structure of the information.
Absolutely. So this is clarity is the most important part of conversion because it's all about immediacy and clarity, just being able to communicate your value prop clearly. And your value prop is typically communicated by your headline, your subhead, and the main hero image, the main media component, the picture, the photo, the diagram, whatever it is. It's mainly the text, but it's also backed up by that main visual, because it could be creating an atmospheric kind of mood that is relevant, or it could be a photo of your product, which is absolutely key, especially if you're selling a physical good. Clarity is the key there, and there's lots of quick experiments you can run to see if you're communicating correctly. My favorite is a 5-second test, you can do this many ways. You can go to usabilityhub.com, you can do it online. But the basic premise is you show people the above the fold experience, because your value prop typically is just above the fold because it's that immediate first impression. So you show them a screenshot about 5 seconds, then you hide it and you ask a question to see how much information they can recall from seeing that. And this is where you'll start learning whether A, your writing is terrible, or your design is terrible, or you've got too many distractions so people weren't actually able to read it in that amount of time, or whether you've got too much text or whatever it is, too many distracting links. We'll get into that, but it's a great way. And then you can look at the typical way it works, and you can do it on usabilityhub.com, or you can do it with your laptop screen. Okay. You know, find someone, open it, 5 seconds, close it. You can do it with a piece of paper, show it to them, and then put it on the table. And let's say, like on Usability Hub, you typically start with maybe 25 participants. And two ways of doing, and basically what you need to do a little bit of manual work, because you'll get a lot of, unless you put in like yes, no, or very actual choices, but if you have open-ended, like what do you think this company sells? That's one of my favorites.
Okay.
Yeah, so that would be one of the questions you could ask. So what do you think this company sells? Or what product or service do they offer? And then you can look at all the responses, and you basically have to count like how many people got it right. And if you see only 10% got it right, you know you have a clarity problem. And then you can work on refining that. And it's just a great, really simple way of doing it. Now, on Usability Hub, it does cost to put it out to their network, but you can do it for free in two different ways. You can send the link to the experiment to your own network. That's free. Right. Or you can participate in other people's 5 second tests, and that earns you credits that you can then spend. So it's a great system. And what something I noticed, particularly in SaaS, so SaaS founders out there, when you're writing your headline and subhead, often I found that the headline, people try to get a bit clever and they're not really being very clear. They just try and have a fancy headline. And then all of the clarity is in the subhead. Now, that is the job of your subhead, to add clarity, but it shouldn't be the only thing that's clear. So one thing I like to do is run the 5 second test and then do a headline flip. Basically, you change your screenshot, but you take your headline, put it in the subhead, put your subhead and put it in the headline. I just flip the order of them, run it again. And if your score goes up, then the number of people who answer your question correctly, then you know that you have a clarity problem in your main headline. And you can work on just kind of adding a bit more, I combine them two together, or add a bit more of the information in the subhead into the headline. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't use clever headlines or fun headlines, but typically not on your website or your main branded landing pages. You might do that for campaigns where your ad is being a bit more sassy or clever, something like that, then that is the time to do that. So you don't be afraid of having fun with your advertising, but you tend to need that just for that. For your standard branded advertising or campaigns, you want to kind of just focus on like absolute clarity, because there's a lot of the way, like if you have competitors, people will be searching for, let's say you landing page software. People will search for that, and then they'll get a bunch of ads or the first few organic links, and they may hold down a key on their keyboard, like Command or Control if it's Mac or PC, and then just click all of those links, opening them up in tabs, or they might right-click on them, opening them in tabs. Then they go in comparison shopping mode, and they'll just quickly click through the tabs. Is that what I was looking for? Is that what I was looking for? And they'll just close that tab if they don't see it immediately. That's how important the immediacy of clear communication is, because it's a once and done situation sometimes if people can't figure it out that quickly.
Absolutely. Makes sense. So we already obviously have headlines, then subheadlines, then we have like explanation text. So like, are you a fan of a long form explanation text or very short form? Why and why not?
I would start with short. It depends what you're doing. If you're doing, say you're selling an information product or something, or maybe something that costs a lot of money, you might have more of the long form sales page. I find them a bit sleazy a lot of the time, but they do work. But even with a great product, and if you want to do one, you can do it in a nice way. My recommendation, if you're writing a sales page, which is more of a storytelling exercise where you keep getting into the benefits, the pain, the benefit, as you go down the page, I would research Amy Harrison. She's a copywriter out of the UK. She's hilarious and she's brilliant. And she has entire sections on her blog, on her website about writing sales pages. And they're phenomenal. So that's where I would encourage anyone to start when they're thinking about their value proposition. Go and pay attention to someone like Amy Harrison. Yeah. So, and it depends on what your product is, really. But I think it's good to start shorter and then maybe use an exit pop-up or just in the corner, like trying to do some surveys to see people, like ask, was there anything missing from this page, or is there anything else you need to know? And then you can learn what people need and you can add more and more copy in there to just, once you start evaluating what people are needing.
Makes sense. Let's talk about the other component. So that would be the page navigation and the folds. So what are your views on like how long should the page be, the folds be, and like how many folds, etc.?
Yeah, it's kind of the classic, how long is a piece of string? which it's just like it's twice the length of half of it. It's twice half of its length. It's as long as it needs to be. But you can think of it like this. For many years, like back in the day, people were afraid of the folds because people didn't scroll. Now, that was the behavior back in the 80s. Okay. Not the 80s, like the start of the web, so the late 90s or whatever, you know, when Jacob Nielsen was doing all his research. So not everybody scrolled then. That's not the case anymore. People are very used to scrolling. Mice are much better. It's much faster to scroll.
Right.
So don't be afraid of that. People will go below the fold. The important thing is above the fold is your main value prop. That's the clarity. That's the immediacy part. But people will scroll. And we've found in experimentation we've done that, you know, people are afraid of the fold. So they'll put their call to action above the fold. There's no way. Well, you shouldn't go below the fold. We found that by putting it below the fold, sometimes, like say a form, put it a little bit down the page sometimes, unless it's really simple. If it's an ebook landing page, put it at the top.
Right.
Everybody knows what that page is about.
Obviously.
But if it's a click-through page, say you're running ads about landing page software for Unbounce, right? They come in, you're communicating what it's all about. Having the call to action at the bottom of the page, we found can work because what it does is, A, it makes people relax a bit because they're not having this thing thrown in their face, but it also makes them hunt for it. If they're interested, they have to go find it, which means they're going to scroll down the page and see more of your content before they find it. It's a good way of helping people see more. Now, navigation, that's a really important one. I'm glad you brought that up.
Right.
Because one of the key differences, again, between a website and a landing page is the navigation. One of the failings of landing pages when they're done wrong is that people have, and why homepages are bad, there's so many links. There's so many ways that someone can either escape, go somewhere else, get distracted,
exactly.
Just lose the plot, basically, that you want to focus the page entirely on the goal of your campaign, nothing else, and don't let them leave. So typically that would mean you don't have any navigation. You take away your nav bar, all they can do is everything on the page. However, there are exceptions to that. Okay. And there's the concept called attention ratio, which is the ratio of the number of things you can do on a page, number of interactive elements, the number of links, number of places you can get links that might take you somewhere else, to the number of things they should be doing. And when you're running a marketing campaign, you only have one goal.
Right.
So you should have an attention ratio of 1-1, one link, one call to action. The exception to this is there are several exceptions. You can have navigation, but it should be anchor navigation. So that's, you know, when you have a longer page, you click on the nav and it brings you further down the same page. It doesn't take you away. That's just really helpful and it makes the page better. So that's a great landing page technique. However, there are two types of anchor links. There's jump and there's smooth scroll. You should never use a jump link, which is basically when you click it, it just immediately...
It's very jarring to the user.
Yeah. And people don't know what's happened. So they might think they're on a new page. That's how it feels. So they might hit the back button.
Oh.
Of course, the back button at that point is going to take them back to the search results. So they may then click on someone else and you've lost them there. So having the smooth scroll, so when you click it, it scrolls down the page. People go, oh, I'm just going further down. Oh, I see there's other content here, right? That immediately teaches them how your page operates. And that's a great way because then, because you have that navigation there, keeps them on the page, but because of that navigation, you can see what people are clicking on. You can use Hotjar or any other kind of heat map software.
Right.
Hotjar has tons of stuff, great stuff, like surveys and heat maps, all kinds of things, form analytics. But you can then see what people are clicking on. So you can go, oh, people are most interested in, you know, checking out features or pricing or they're most interested in whatever you've written in your navigation. You can learn a lot in terms of what people most are interested in and what you might actually be able to remove from your page because people aren't asking through their clicking to actually go to that section. So that's super helpful. Other links that are okay are things that open up in a light box, you know, like a modal pop-up, like say an image gallery or a form or terms and conditions, privacy policy, anything like that. That's totally cool. Basically, you're trying to design an experience that where people can interact because interaction is key to conversion. I've done a lot of experimentation where the more engaged people are, the more interactive you can make it, the more often that level of interaction can be somewhat correlated to people who convert. But yeah, you're trying to just keep people on the page. That's the fundamental thing. Don't be afraid of putting things below the fold and use navigation properly.
Cool. So let's talk about one very key component. That would be the media components you talked earlier mm-hmm. also. So like pictures, graphics, GIFs, videos, whatnot. So what are your thoughts? Like, why are they first of all important along with the copy headlines, and how to use them best in a landing page?
Yeah, so they're incredibly important because, you know, people are impatient, aren't going to read everything on your page. They might scroll down quickly and scan the subheads, and I've got a good exercise for that as well. But that main visual is really going to tell them something, especially if there's a product. If it's a screenshot of your software, you got to be careful there because sometimes it's not very helpful and won't really aid in the clarity, because that's what your hero shot is trying to do as well. It's like enhance the clarity so people get it more quickly. A great experiment for that as well. Again, it's a 5-second test, but what you do, you take your main image, whether it's typically an image, you can do a video as well, and you take it in isolation. So just that photo or that diagram or that screenshot, and you run a 5-second test and you ask, what does this product or service do? Because if people struggle to figure that out in isolation, then that image is not actually helping.
Interesting.
And there are two ways to solve that. One would be change it, like get rid of it or update it, like learn about it and work on making it more clear until people do answer correctly. Or the simplest and fastest way, if you're short on time or ideas, is just to put a caption on it. People are drawn to captions associated with or below images because it helps their comprehension really quickly. They're also very important for video because if you want someone to watch your video, they may not have headphones. They may be in a quiet place and in an open office or a library or wherever, on the bus, on the train, on the commute. So you need to inspire them to put their headphones in. And a really great caption can help people do that. If you explain what it is, it's only a short video and it's about this, something catchy. Also the poster frame, which is basically the default thumbnail image you see on your video before you hit play. Really important. Don't let it be the default one, which is probably a blank screen right. or some awkward pose.
Right.
Use an image, like either, you know, you can go through on software sometimes and choose the part of the video, do that, or actually create a graphic that's really clear and high res and quirky or funny. Something that will make people go, oh, I wanna check that out. That's a great way to inspire more clicks. So yeah, and stock photos. Now you may, let's say you're Nate, you have clients. Maybe your business is that you serve clients, you do something for them. Right. You'll fall into the trap a lot where they may have an existing site and they have stock photos in there. And you're like, no, you shouldn't use stock photos. And they're like, well, we want to, or why not? Because usually the rationale behind that is because you shouldn't. And that's not really helpful. Right. So the best thing you can do, and this is if you have them yourself as well. Because mm-hmm. Often, like I said, if you bought a theme, whether it's a one-page theme or a WordPress theme for like a whole site, you'll be tempted to just try and fill in the images often with stock. The first thing you want to do if you have stock images of your own or someone else's is put them through tineye.com. So tineye.com.
Okay.
Basically, you put the URL of the image in there and it looks around the internet. It has this massive database of millions and millions of images, and it'll tell you how many times it's been used and where. So if you need ammunition, either for yourself or for a client or a stakeholder, then you can take this to them. You can take them this website, this page that says this has been used. This, and if you're a SaaS founder, you may fall prey to this. Don't do it. It's so common when they put their website together. The main hero image is an overhead shot of a desk with a laptop and a coffee cup.
Right.
A laptop and a coffee cup says nothing about your business for the most part, most likely. So I've done TinEye things with that, lookups, and I've found ones that have been used 1,900 times. And that is terrible. So you can use that evidence. Now, if it's been used 10 times and you can look where it's been used, if it's in places that are nothing to do with your industry and you love the image, that's cool. Okay. Go with it. If it really helps communication, if it's a good one. Second tip is go to unsplash.com. They're an amazing, we just partnered with them. They have like millions of images, but the difference with them and other stock places is they're entirely free, but they're also awesome. It's just this crowdsourced, amazing community of generous photographers who are putting all this high quality work in there, and it's completely free for any commercial use. We just integrated so you can, inside Unbounce, you can search for images from that library and put them right on your landing page. It's brilliant. And regardless of that, it's the best place place to, you know, look for that kind of thing. Because that's what I was doing yesterday for another project I'm working on. Okay. It's really cool. So if you don't have photography, that's the best place to start. But also try and create your own original photography. It doesn't have to be difficult or expensive. You know, phones are high quality these days. So try to do that kind of thing because it'll come across as more authentic. But okay. Back to Fold very quickly, a design thing. So like the Fold, you can get a false bottom. Like say you have different page sections and they're horizontal. It can look sometimes, if nothing's breaking the plane at the bottom of the screen, it can look like that's all there is. That's one of the times when people might not scroll, especially on a Mac. Sometimes you'll see that your scroll bar doesn't appear unless you start scrolling.
Oh, yeah.
The browser. So you may be on this page where it looks like there's nothing below the Fold. The scroll bar isn't there to tell you that you're only 10% of the way down. So a great way to... A new design trend that's good is asymmetric designs. So you'll see it sometimes where, you know, there'll be a light colored section and a light one, dark one, but like the breaks aren't horizontal. They're like diagonal. So you can see it helps break the plane as you go down. It visually tells you there's something else going on. Right. And that can encourage scrolling.
Right. Makes sense. Now, finally, forms with fields and call to action buttons. So can you give us a guide on these, how to use them?
Yes. One thing I've noticed, this is a really great hack, or it's just a tip. Field labels can be quite powerful. Like, you know, you ask for name, email address, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
The one I found that can be really impactful is the email address field. What you want as a founder, as a new business, you want people's business email address.
Right.
You don't want their Gmail, Hotmail, whatever.
Right.
You want name@companyname.com. You want ollie@unbounce.com. Because A, then you know who's signing up, then you can get excited about that because that's awesome, and you can do personal outreach knowing something about that person. But more importantly, if you have their business email address, you know when you do your email marketing later on that you're communicating to them when they're in the office, making business decisions, thinking about business in their business inbox,
right?
As opposed to the Gmail account later in the day. So the way you get that is instead of saying email address on the form field, ask for what you want. Say business email address or work email address. I found like up to a 30-50% increase in professional email addresses just by adding that one word, business or work.
Oh, wow.
So that's a great way of doing that. Number of form fields. People are scared of like, oh, I shouldn't add more form fields. Everybody used to have this fear. I used to have this fear, but we've dispelled it in experimentation. It's not. If you're doing something very simple, an ebook, typically you don't ask for much unless you have a, but if you're pushing these leads through to a sales team, that's when you do need to ask more because you don't, it's much better to have 100 leads where people have asked your questions, answered your questions, like size of company, your role, something like that, because maybe the target of your customers is marketing teams from 30 to 50 people.
Right.
You don't want a solopreneur putting their information in there. You want to help them, so you want them to get this information, this ebook or whatever. But at the end of the day, that's not your target market. So you need to design for ideal. So in that case, you want to ask for a business email address. You want to have fields that ask, that qualify them so that your sales team has something useful to work with. And so, you know, that's some things like that. Don't be afraid of the extra form fields. Other things, your call to action. What should it say? Well, the first thing it shouldn't say is submit. Right now, we know
it's too generic. That,
yeah, we know what it's going to do. We know that you click the button, it's going to submit the form. Everybody knows that. So it won't necessarily hurt your conversion rate by having the word submit there. But what it is doing is it's a missed opportunity to be a bit more persuasive and add a bit more clarity as to what's going to happen, what you're going to get when you click it. And that all just kind of goes together to a better user experience. Now, something we have seen that impacts conversion rate is some different words you use in your call to action on your form. So things like we looked at data from thousands of landing pages, and the word when I ask people what's the most persuasive word in the English language, a lot of people say free. It's not. It's actually the word because, and that's because we're kind of primed as children to believe what comes after that. Because we ask questions of our parents. You know, why is the sky blue? Because, right?
Right.
So we were trained to learn. So that's a persuasive word. I'm not saying use that on your buttons. It's just like it's not things like free. And we've seen some signals that the word free actually can hurt conversion rates. Okay. Maybe that's because, I don't know why, maybe it's because it devalues it. Maybe it's because people don't believe it's free, because we know it's an exchange of social currency. I'm giving you my details. I know you're going to market to me, so I don't believe it's free. But things that have positively influenced it are adding a bit of urgency, like the word now, like get it now. And in different situations, my versus your. So should it be get my free ebook or down or start my free trial, start my trial. And when it's important to have the word free, and it's like if it's a software trial and it is free,
that makes sense.
That's the time you need, because that's being clear about what you're actually going to get. So my versus your can have an impact. But the most interesting thing, so I'm good friends with Wistia, professional video software.
Right.
And they looked at some of their data for calls to action that appear inside videos. They have two different kinds. They have annotations. So those are you've seen it in the past. I think they removed it on YouTube, but you'd see in the corner, like as you're going through, a little link would appear in the corner of the video.
Right.
So that's an annotation. So they have that, and they have full screen CTAs as well that take over the entire screen. And so we looked at words on forms that from our data, and then words in annotations and full screen CTAs in videos. And what we found is that every page has a conversion opportunity. Every conversion opportunity needs a call to action, but every call to action is unique. So what we found, and it makes sense, when you used the word my, it worked better on the full screen.
Okay.
Maybe because it's right in front of your face, whereas in the corner, your worked better. If you said now for urgency, that didn't work full screen right in your face, but it did work in the corner. Using words like action words like click and click here, if you put them right in someone's face, it performed less, or like worse. But if it was over in the corner, so it performed better. So the interesting thing is you can't just take one piece of data and apply it everywhere. Everything is unique, but it makes sense there, because if it's off in the corner, saying click here is a signal you're instructing people the right thing to do, like click over here. But if it's in their face, same with exclamation points. Having them in the corner can work. Having them in your face, like it's shouting, didn't work. So all these things, super interesting, but you have to be careful, because your call to action is a very sensitive thing.
Right.
You can succeed or fail, based on that alone. So, but the important thing is to experiment with those different things based on where and how it's being presented.
These type of benchmark data that you mentioned quite many times, do you guys publish that on like from Unbounce or like what?
We don't. It's mainly, I've used it in my talks when I do public speaking. And the Wistia data, I talk about that in my talks too, but some of that they've published, but most of it was just, they did it just for me. I was working with them.
Okay.
So I don't think they published that. If you share any, if you have any show notes or anything on the podcast, I don't know if you do anywhere
to,
ask me after and I can send you one of my slides that has some of this comparative data.
Okay, cool. What other components could be there to make a great landing page that we might have missed? So one I could think of, testimonials.
Yes. Yeah. Social proof is key. But, and here's the thing, when you're starting out, your early stage, you might not have any customers.
Right.
So the number one thing you should not do is lie. There are so many fake testimonials out there, and people can smell that BS a mile away. They're hyperbolic. Like they just say, oh, this thing changed my life. It's the best thing ever. And it's a photo of someone that's not at all in that tribe, in that, like the person you'd expect to, be using that product or service. I was critiquing a landing page for a photography course, and in the social proof, and I did the research, I found all these photographers, they were legit, they were very good, but the photos and the testimonials, nobody was holding a camera. So just a very simple thing, and that's context of use. If you can demonstrate context of use, what it looks like or feels like to use your product, or at least a signal that it's legit, that will help you. So first of all, if you don't have customers, don't make up a testimonial, wait. As soon as you have a customer, ask them. But then there's there's an anatomy of a landing page, there's an anatomy of a great testimonial. And the key to a great testimonial is demonstrating the transformational impact of using your product or service.
Right.
What is before and after? That's why those sleazy, health photos of like before and after ad photos, that's the reason they work, because it's transformational. And you can do that in your testimonials. You just have to ask the right questions. So I have a script, testimonial equation, customer interview scripts, because I reverse engineered some really good testimonials to figure out the anatomy. And I'll read off some of the questions here. We can share this in the show notes too.
Sure.
But these are designed to create the information you need to craft a transformational and impactful testimonial. And you need to do outreach to get testimonials, but don't just say, hey, can you give me a testimonial and then use what they send, because what they send back usually won't be good enough.
Right.
Sometimes it will be. What you want to do is interview them, come up with your own, send it back to them and say, hey, can I use it like this? Like, okay. Always ask for permission, but craft it yourself. So some of the examples of questions, which things have changed in your business because of our product or service, transformational? How have they changed? Can you describe how it feels to see that change? If you were to quantify the change, what metrics have changed and by how much? Do you have examples of before and after in the form of photos? Would you be willing to record a video testimonial? May I have a photo of you or whoever uses the product service actually using it? And then I'll also need the name, role, company name if it's a client, and links to any published materials documenting your use case. Things like that. If you can get some of that information, you can have a rich, legitimate, authentic, powerful, and transformational testimonial that really helps your case from a social perspective.
Makes sense. So let's move to the next topic, which is landing page optimization. So could you explain like what is meant by that, and also a little bit about the metrics and funnel and maths of a landing page?
Yeah, the number one thing to know about optimization. So optimization in simple terms is just making something better, right? You're making it perform better in some way, whether it's conversion rate, whether it's, click-through rate, could be number of leads, it could be time on page, could be the number of people who scroll to the bottom, whatever your metric is. Optimization is just making that better.
Right.
Now, people confuse A-B testing and optimization. A-B testing is just one thing you do to help optimize. It's just a tool, a technique to help you, achieve the optimization. But the number one problem with A-B testing, and this will happen to every single person in the history of the internet who starts A-B testing, unless you have an expert guiding you, you will do it wrong. Everybody does it wrong. I did it wrong. And for a couple of reasons, first of all, if you don't have a lot of traffic, which is what every new founder is going to go through, you shouldn't be testing. Do not run an A-B test. First thing you should do is use a sample size calculator, and I can share a link for that. Basically, you put in how much traffic you get and then how much you expect to increase conversions. That's a hard one. I would just put in 10% or 20%, and then it will tell you, based on your traffic and to get a test that it has a significant outcome, it will tell you how long the test needs to run for. And if you don't have a lot of traffic, the answer is going to be, you might say 7 years. And if it's anything longer than a month, typically you're not ready. So don't do it. In that case, what you have to do if you have low traffic, plot out your traffic trajectory. Look at it over time. How much is it growing? And then plot out how long it's going to be until you have enough traffic to do an A-B test. Okay. Then you know, it's going to be 4 months, then we'll have enough traffic. Cool. Now I can spend those 4 months learning about my customer, doing research, because again, you shouldn't run a test unless you've done research to create a hypothesis that's actually based on solid information and insight. Right. So that's like looking at heat maps, looking at Google Analytics, doing interviews, all that kind of stuff to figure out what problems might actually exist so you can come up with a hypothesis for a test. So you do that kind of stuff, do 5-second tests, do usability tests where you have someone in the room and you give them tasks to complete and you watch them try to do that. All those things give you insights and you can just implement some of them. That's not the ideal. A test is the scientific way of doing it, but you can just implement things and just kind of see if it has a positive impact.
Right.
But do all of that research so that when you have enough traffic, you're ready and you have a really intelligent test to run. So that's how you should do A-B testing, right? And also the other mistake that everybody makes is stopping it too early. Every test you run will have a spike at the beginning because the sample size is so small in the first few days, unless you got a giant e-commerce site, but this is early stage founders, you won't have that. There's a spike at the beginning because you've only had 20 visitors and maybe one of them has two conversions, one has one. Oh, that's a 50%, that's 100% increase for page B. Let's launch that. No, that's just false information. You need to let it run, until based on the sample size calculator, but also look at A-B test calculator. I'll share the link with you again.
Sure.
This is a way you put in all your data. So you put in how much traffic you've got, how many conversions, and it will tell you statistically how strong the result is. And it'll say not significant yet, keep going. Or it'll say, yes, you have a significant result. You can stop your test and believe that one is better than the other. That's the only time you should be stopping your test. It's reached the point where the information is true. Because if it's not, if you're reacting to something that isn't, statistically relevant yet, you can make a big negative impact on your business, because then all of a sudden you put a different page live or a change live. And in 6 weeks' time, when the test probably should have run for, you're going to see the truth and your conversion rates may have gone down and you may have forgotten about what you did. And all of a sudden your business is failing to an extent, like 5% worse than it was. So you have to be very careful when you run tests.
Right. Suppose we have a substantial amount of traffic. So like, what would you suggest to do A-B tests on? Any examples?
Many schools of thought there. Some people say run as many tests as you can to learn quickly. Typically that is kicked off by people getting a brainstorm session. They go, well, what should we test? That's not really the way you should do it. I mean, okay. You will have a lot of ideas at the beginning, right. And you should start working through those ideas, but you need to back them up with research so that it's not just your opinion. We used to run tests because testing is really fun. When, you know, because you're like, oh, it's exciting. Is it going to win? Is my business going to perform better than it did? It's incredibly exciting. We'd run like 6 headlines against one another, just like change. Oh, I think this sounds cooler. And we'd react too quickly and we'd go, no, that one's not working. That one's not working. It's a terrible thing to do. And if you have a lot of traffic, you can have more variance. So an A-B test is not just A versus B. It's A-B-N. It could be A, B, C, D, E. You have as many as you want, but you need to have enough traffic to handle that many variants. It goes up dramatically if you, every time you add an extra one in there. But yeah, you're going to have testing ideas, but the best tests are based on an observed pain, an observed problem. But also, you got to look at your analytics for broken things. A lot of the time, you'll have a segment, like say people coming from IE, Internet Explorer or something, or you know, Firefox version 10.2, they may be getting a bug. They may not be able to actually complete the conversion goal. So your conversion rate might be like 15%, but that's because 30% of your traffic is 2 or 0, right? So it's a misinformation. You have to dig out those things. QA is the second most important part of marketing. The first part of marketing is being really good at marketing. The second part is making sure things aren't broken.
So what's an ideal strategy here? Like, should we make multiple landing pages for, let's say, specific target users, or let's say an ad we are running on social media? Or should we make one landing page and do multivariate testing, etc. on that? So, like, what are your views on this?
Multivariate testing. So that's the idea that you run multiple pages with many different changes and it figures out the best combination of those. You need an obscene amount of traffic to run a multivariate test. Okay. You, for the most part, you should never even use those words.
Okay.
Don't even consider it. And even if you do have enough traffic, it can be confusing because, yeah, eventually it'll say this combination of this headline with this testimonial with this button with blah, 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 is performing best, but you'll have no idea why. If you've run a good A-B test, you've learned something. Even if it loses, you learned something because you did it for the right reason. You did it based on a solid hypothesis. Right. When you're randomly just letting shit figure itself out, you're not learning. So then your next test, you might just undo all of that because you don't know why it actually worked. But personalization is important. Now, you know, especially as you mature, you get a more better understanding of your customer segments and how different they are. And you have your base. So one thing that's common as you grow is that if you add more products or you start changing things, you start doing new content, marketing, whatever, you can sometimes forget the fundamentals. You can forget that base customer archetype, the one that was the foundation of your success. We did this. We launched some new products and we focused a lot on them, the new content for them. And we kind of forgot about landing pages.
Right.
We did pop-ups and sticky bars and we stopped writing so much about landing pages. And that had a negative impact because you get excited about the shiny new thing and you want to push that really hard, but you should never forget the fundamentals. So, you know, figure out your segments. There's a great quote by Marshall Goldsmith, "What got us here won't get us there." So at the same time as focusing on the fundamentals, you have to keep up with how your customers are maturing. If they're growing as a company, they're going to start moving up the ladder to more enterprise software or other things, and you have to grow with them to keep them. So you have to constantly evaluate who they are. And then you can take that information, you can segment your acquisition channels, your onboarding campaigns with landing pages. So let's say you're bringing people in through your main landing page and your website, then you can start emailing them, sequence of emails, strip campaign or something. But that's where you want to use the segmentation so that the different segments are going to different landing pages that have different onboarding campaigns.
Right.
Because if you know this about this person, you're like, oh, they're more advanced. I'm going to put them into this segment and they're going to get different messaging. They're going to get onboarded more quickly or in a different manner. So that's a great way to use segmentation. And you can learn some of that when you're doing lead gen if you ask those questions in the form. That's why it's so important, not just for sales, but for marketing. When you get those answers, you can use those to segment inside your your email software so that then, oh, these are in the 30 to 50 team size. Oh, these are in agency. These are, these guys are in the US. These are in the UK. These are in Australia.
Right.
You can tailor then. You can put them in different lists based on that, onboard them differently. And, you know, if you're in North America, it's very common to start an email with, hey, name, exclamation point. But in the UK, it's hi. And so that's a subtle difference. But also, I've had feedback from people going, why are you shouting at me? Like, because to Brits, saying, hey, is kind of like you're shouting. They don't see it as this friendly thing. It's changing a bit because of TV and people get it. Culture expands. But those little nuances are important. And if you're emailing people in Australia, they have a different sense of humor. There's different things going on there. And you can bring some of that in if you're able to segment based on those first questions you ask. And that's also, you might, when you're starting, well, we want as many leads as possible. Let's just put one field in there. You'll regret that later on.
Right.
When you want to segment, then you've got to do something else to learn about them and segment them. And that's really hard. It's much better to start, doing it right. And especially if you're doing paid advertising, when you can use ad targeting features to do the segmentation, drive them to a very specific landing page for that segment. So yeah, landing pages are a key part of speaking to people in the way they need to be spoken to, because nobody who's advanced wants to be spoken to like they're a basic left understanding person.
Great. So like what happens after landing page conversion, or perhaps I should ask, like, what should happen after each and every landing page conversion, like thank you page or like some sort of interaction?
Yeah, a couple of things. Well, before and after, before, don't create one for the sake of creating one.
Okay.
Right. Only create one if you need one.
Okay.
That's the first thing. But afterwards, yeah, after the conversion, so typically you will have a confirmation page, a thank you page. It might be a pop-up, maybe like a modal dialogue, like a Lightbox thank you page. Have to ask for something else, right? It's common for people just to go, oh, thank you. thanks for your email address. We'll be in touch. No, they've just said they're interested in you. Give them something else, but don't ask for too much on the second step. Don't be like, oh, you signed up for our newsletter. Do you want to start a free trial of our software? No, I don't even know what you do. I just came here through organic search, found a blog post. I liked it. I want to subscribe to the blog. I have no idea what you do. So don't be aggressive. What you might want to do is, oh, thanks for subscribing. You might be interested in this webinar we're putting on, which gets into a lot more detail on that same topic. So it's still content-based. And then at the end of your webinar, you can ask people, say, hey, if you want to stick around, we're going to be doing a product demo related to the content we just talked about. So again, keep it relevant and push people closer and closer. We do that, and we have a lot of people that will just stick around at the end because they want to see it in action. Then you show your product, but don't be like, here's a webinar about copywriting, and then jump into your product and start talking about design. That's a disconnect. So always think about them and this relevant story as you go through. E-commerce, similar. You want to ask, give people a coupon code afterwards to come back the next time, or give them another product idea that they might want up in their inbox for next time, or to buy something now. So always ask for something. Yeah, but also, don't forget about these landing pages, because over time, when you scale, you'll have lots of them. Some will get old. Maybe you're running a bunch of paid ads. You'll have one, you'll change, you'll pause campaigns, you'll do new ones. You might still have these pages live, or they may, because remember that at the start, organic traffic, website, campaign traffic, landing pages. Typically, especially if you're doing paid, you don't want the landing page to be indexed by search engines, because then that's going to pollute your data, because you're going to have people coming that you're paying for, but then you have organic traffic that maybe isn't as qualified because they didn't come through that path that was very targeted. And that's going to, they may have a lower conversion rate, and all your data is going to get screwed up. So don't index your pages unless it's an evergreen thing. Like, say you make an ebook and it's something you want to run forever.
Okay.
Index that because then you want that. But so you have to audit every now and then. Look at your landing page, unpublish them, update them. Maybe you have new thoughts on, maybe your models change, your thinking's change, your content's change, your products evolve. Do that. But also, if you need to retire them or unpublish them, 301 them to a new page. Some page that is getting organic traffic. And not to be, I'm a terrible salesperson, but I will say that's a feature we have. So once you unpublish a page, you can 301 it to anywhere you want. But it's a great idea, because I've had emails I'll see that have been gone to the marketing team saying, okay, we have 1,400 landing pages.
Right.
300 of them are not being used. Like, everybody go and figure out which ones are yours and figure out which ones aren't being used, and we'll figure out a place to 301 them, because you will, as you scale, you will forget about some of them.
Makes sense. So, Ollie, that was pretty much it. Any final advice you would give to founders related to landing pages? Like any big mistakes you see in startups doing very often, or you something that you think startups need to do more and more of?
Just remember, as you grow, your product is going to grow too, and you need to retest your positioning, because if you have new products or just new features, the benefits are going to change of your product. So, don't be afraid of changing your positioning, you know, because that's that whole thing. What got us here won't get us there.
Right.
Because if you evolved, your value prop has to evolve too. So that's where you come right back to the research thing, to the validation, start running some campaigns, testing different value props that are associated with the changes in your business, in your company, or whatever it is, so that you're ready to update that. Because, you know, your competitors are going to be doing this too. And if they get ahead of you on that because they're, you know, updating it, you need to look at that. You need to look at your cost per acquisition and look at different cohorts. Who are your ideal customers? Because you'll learn over time who's the best, so you can target them. Maybe you need to change your value prop because you need to acquire this segment because they stay with you like 3 times longer. They're worth 1.4 times lifetime value. Hmm. You need to know all of that stuff so that you can segment and change accordingly.
Any resource you'd suggest to listeners for learning more about landing pages? Any books, people, blogs, anything?
Blogs are the best place. And obviously, the Unbalanced blog is the best place for landing pages because that's our thing, right? I've written 350 blog posts about landing pages.
Wow.
So there's plenty of stuff on there. Some resources, the blog, but also a really cool thing. I mentioned QA is important. One of the things we have in there is a landing page analyzer. It's totally free.
Okay.
You put in the URL of your page, and it will analyze it based on the key. You can tell it your conversion rate, tell it the keywords you're doing in for organic or for your paid, and it will analyze your page and it'll give you a ton of actionable advice about whether you have the keywords are on there. It'll use some of our machine learning to look at the copy on your page and see whether the readability is in the right level, and lots of advice. It will look at your social graph tags to see if you have them, because if you're not, you're sharing a page on social, the preview that shows up on Facebook or LinkedIn or Twitter can be totally wrong. So this will tell you if it's wrong and give you the code to do it. It will tell you if your images are too big, and it will give you optimized versions to download. It won't just tell you, it'll give you better images. Wow. So super useful at optimize your page, but also as a last step in your QA process.
Right.
Before you launch a campaign, run it through there and it will catch some mistakes. And it's just a great tool to make sure you don't mess up your marketing.
Great. I'll share the link in the show notes, definitely. Anything you like to plug in, your Twitter or LinkedIn, how can people reach out to you?
Twitter is the best for me. That's where I'm most active. And I'll get back to you right away. I'm Ollie Gardner on Twitter. So yeah, that's generally the best way to reach out.
Well, Ollie, thank you so much for all the insights. It was like a pleasure having you on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks again for having me on.
That's it, folks. Thanks for listening. Show notes would be available on the website insightsally.com. Please rate, review, subscribe in whichever app you are listening to this episode. The podcast is available everywhere: iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, etc., and even YouTube. And remember, always be learning. Bye.